Our second story today looks at how the time before death has become extended, prolonged even for years, and wonders, can you finish grieving even before the person dies?
In Orthodox Judaism, a death is followed by a period of intense mourning. The immediate family of the deceased go through a week-long shiva, during which they don't bathe, don't shave, and cover every mirror in the house while receiving visitors.
Hindu funeral rites include laying the body on the floor and lighting a lamp beside it that is kept burning for 3 days.
Buddhists say funeral prayers weekly for 49 days after a death, at which point the dead are reborn in a new body.
Here in the West, we have our own set of mourning rituals, and these rituals are changing as new medical technology prolongs the dying process.
These days, dying can be drawn out for a long time. Doctors and modern hospitals can keep a very sick person living, perhaps barely living, for months or even years.
And as our sick loved one hangs on, so do we. Perhaps the human process of mourning has adapted to stretch and fill this waiting time.
Or maybe our grief simply runs its course, and we accept the approaching death before it actually occurs.
I'm Daniel McDougall.
And I'm Rachel Dowling. Recently, we've both observed family members' lives slowly slipping away. We interviewed some of our relatives about what this new, longer grieving process is like. My uncle Phil lives in coastal Georgia. Here's how my dad described him before he was diagnosed with renal cancer.
He was very robust. He was fairly tall, I guess close to 6 feet or 6'1 or something like that. He was never slender, but he had a robust build, certainly not overweight. At the time, he had full head of hair, and I believe he had a mustache.
He's a fun, impulsive guy. We have to hide pecan balls and chocolates from him to keep his diabetes in check. Oh, but I forgot to tell you his name. It's
César Gregorio Felipe Fermín Estrada Salcedo.
What was that?
César Gregorio Felipe Fermín Estrada Salcedo. Everyone calls me Phil.
These are two of Phil's children, Janet and Philip. Philip is 21 and Janet's 19. Phil's other two children, Laura and David, are in high school. The four of them live with their parents, attend several church services a week, play with their cat and gerbil, go to the YWCA, and generally keep busy. It was a normal, fast-paced week in spring when Phil's children were told he was in the hospital.
Yeah, actually, I was at school, and my brother came to pick us up, and he said, you know, come with us, Dad's in the hospital, and when we got to the hospital room, my dad told us.
This is my cousin Laura in May of 2006. She was a sophomore in high school. Her dad, my uncle, had just been diagnosed with stage 3 renal cancer, and initial tests showed that there were metastases in 11 lymph nodes. Tumors were spreading all through his body.
I think it was kind of just like shock. Like, I couldn't really believe it. You know how my dad used to be, like this big, strong, healthy man, and then he was like laying in this hospital bed saying that he has cancer. Like, it's just a big change.
Once it became clear that Phil's condition was a terminal illness, his children began something that is referred to in bereavement literature as preemptive grief, a kind of grief that starts even before a death has occurred. In order to better understand types of grief, we consulted the experts and came across Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's influential book, On Death and Dying. In it, she identifies the 5 stages of grief one normally goes through when one experiences a tragedy: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. The Ross model allows for a range of responses to the passing of a loved one, and though they each reacted differently to their father's degeneration, Janet, Laura, Philip, and David all progressed through the 5 stages laid out by the Kubler-Ross model. Stage 1, denial. As the months extended and treatment after treatment failed, Phil's kids still had trouble coming to terms with what they were seeing. They wanted to ignore the disease. They wanted to pretend that it wasn't going to claim their father. It's hard now to go back and access that feeling of bewildered denial, but you can still hear it in Janet's voice.
He's not doing that much working right now because he's very under the weather a lot. So, yeah, that's about it.
But eventually, certain facts become totally unavoidable. And it's at this point that you just want to find someone or something to blame. So this is what they did. Stage 2, anger.
Why did Grandpa go into remission and my father didn't? I don't know. That's a hard question to answer.
That was Phil's oldest son, Philip. When Ross described anger, she meant that the Mourning family members radiate anger in all directions. Initially, anger is directed at the diagnosis and the doctors who gave it. But then it can spread to a more general angry questioning. But the anger soon subsides and gives way to the next stage of grief, bargaining. In the third stage, mourners begin to look for hope, to plead for extra time. In my family's case, bargaining included looking for alternative treatments, ways to somehow avoid death. Phil's family certainly did seek out a variety of treatments, almost every kind available. My cousin Laura.
Bouts of chemotherapy, radiation, he's taken countless pills, whatever seems to be out there. He actually did a really extensive, arduous procedure, whatever, that took a month, and he had to be in the hospital for a month and get all his fluids drained and everything. So that was kind of tough, and it didn't work.
This past winter, Phil underwent his longest and most arduous round of chemotherapy yet. But as Laura said, the cancer didn't respond. Everything began to look futile. What was the point of trying anymore? Hopelessness became intertwined with regret. This led to stage 4, depression.
Sometimes I wish I could have spent more time with him. Although I have been involved in the whole process, I haven't been here on a day-to-day basis. So sometimes I feel like I should have been there.
It depresses me.
Philip's sister, Laura.
I think maybe I just push it to the back of my mind and try to have other things to do so I don't think about it.
And finally, just as Ross's model predicts, after the storm of emotions, mourners eventually reach a state of calm, where they come to terms with the facts as they are. This is the fifth and final phase of the grieving process, acceptance. Here's my cousin Janet.
I don't think all of a sudden he's just going to die and we're going to be so unprepared or anything, just because, yeah, we have known for a while.
Philip is at the same stage. I asked him what it might be like when his dad's body eventually gives in to cancer.
Who really knows what happens to him when you die? I think for my father, because he's a believer in Christ, I believe that his death will be a passing from this world into a place with God. That his death, although it'll be painful for us to bear, I think it will unite him with his Maker, with God. It will be a victory for him rather than a curse.
All of my cousins have come through these stages of grief. They've denied, been upset, bargained, lived through depression, and finally accepted death. So in a sense, they're done. But now what? Phil's children have essentially completed the grieving process and arrived at the acceptance of their father's death. But Phil is still lying in his hospice bed, attended by nurses. The fact is, we cannot explain this new stage of grief with the traditional model. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross doesn't account for how we should treat the time between arriving at stage 5 and the event of death. As my dad says, we're left with the question,
how do I react? What am I supposed to do now?
There is no stage 6. Maybe we complete the 5 stages before the moment of death comes. In which case, we've got this new, unnatural space between death's acceptance and actuality. So maybe it's more accurate to say that there is a stage 6, but that it's uncharted territory. My cousins found themselves in this situation after less than 2 years. But for some people, the process can take even longer. Daniel's family experienced a full grieving process, including stage 6, over the course of a decade. He reflects on the loss of his grandmother.
This is the story of my grandmother, Phyllis. About 10 years ago, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Since that time, my mother and her siblings have progressed through the normal 5 stages of grief, and like Rachel's cousins, have found themselves unsure of how to feel in this new stage of grieving. I talked to my mom and her brother about it, and asked each of them to describe their mother's life and the experience of slowly losing her to Alzheimer's.
Her name was Phyllis Pauline Linsky. She hated her middle name, so we've never used it.
This is my mom, Julie.
I'm the fourth child, the youngest of four, two older brothers and an older sister, and then came me. She never said I was a mistake or an accident, but I'm sure I was a surprise. So that's me, Julie.
And this is her older brother.
Yeah, this is Ken Van Train. And, you know, I was the second son to Phyllis and Bill Van Train. You know, the dad was in the Navy, and so he traveled a lot. Mom was kind of the cornerstone of the family. We moved every 2 years, which a lot of people would think is pretty tough on a family, but she was the one who kept everybody together.
She was the cog in our wheel that we all rotated around, because she always organized us, always packed, always got us all set up in schools. Each one of us, even though we were all different, all felt that from her.
Despite their different relationships with her, Phyllis's children remember some of the same stories. This was in 1998.
One of her recipes was chicken fricassee, and one day she just forgot how to make it.
I remember her visiting me, and we were busy with various things, and I was cooking dinner, and then we sat down to eat, and this is a meal that she cooked all her life and was kind of one of our family favorites, so I thought I would do it for her as like a special thing. Well, I remember sitting down to eat, and she'd be like, "Oh, this is great. Where did you get this recipe?"
So you knew something was happening.
When my grandma went to the doctor in 2001, she took some memory tests, and the results confirmed what we already suspected.
She had Alzheimer's.
Now we didn't wonder why my grandmother had trouble remembering things. Our interactions with her were beginning to change, and in some senses, the way we thought of her was changing too. Five years into the disease, my grandmother fell and broke her hip. This was in 2003. It was a tough decision, but we decided that she wasn't able to get all the care she needed at home. So we moved her into a nursing home called Brighton Gardens, close to where my Uncle Ken lives.
Now, Jan and I always went on Sundays. In the beginning, we could take her to church, and we did that for about a year and a half on Sunday, and then took her to brunch.
Moving her into the nursing home took a lot of the burden off our family, but doing so forced us to confront her approaching death. Perhaps we'd been postponing this realization, but now we were propelled through the 5 stages of grief and came to accept the fact that she would soon pass away.
And then slowly the disease takes over, and the progression of her, you know, not remembering us and who we were, our relation to her, starts to go away. And that's always sad. But you were always glad for, like, little glimpses, and I think as more of the memory goes and more of the things, you're just happy for the tiny little glimpse of who she was. So a facial expression or a certain word she would say, or if she called you, if it was always a big deal if she remembered one of our names, you know, and then we'd call each other and say, "Hey, she remembered you." She remembered you, or she remembered my name, or, you know, she mentioned everyone but you, something like that. That's kind of what he ended up doing, was just trying to find a little bit of her each time.
And I look forward to going there every week. I needed to see her.
Alzheimer's claimed more and more of my grandma. Her children still loved her, of course, but as Ken said, she was a different person.
Then what got hard is her communication just went. She she would sit and talk to you as if she was having a conversation, but you couldn't, but the words were kind of more gibberish. You couldn't, none of the words made sense. Occasionally, there would be a time where what she said connected with what you said. You know, and then that was just this great moment that you would have, but it was a tiny little sliver of what normal is, but you were happy for it.
In December, she started to have a stroke. Like once a week, she'd start to get a little stroke.
This is last December. 5 years after she moved into the nursing home, Brighton Gardens, and 10 years after she started showing symptoms.
Well, at first it was once a year, and then it got to once every few months, and then once a month, and then once every week. So you could, you know, you knew from that pattern that it was getting worse. The last time she had it, she went into complete coma.
When my grandma went into the coma, her children finally had to accept what was 10 years in coming. They had already lost her to Alzheimer's. Soon they would lose her to death.
I remember the first day I was there, I was telling her, even though she wasn't conscious, you know, they say that their hearing is the last thing to go. And so I just told her about how I was doing, how the kids were doing. And, you know, and then as time went on, you've kind of told them everything and you just are trying to let them know that it's okay to go.
And she lived about 8 days after she was in the coma. So yeah, at that point we all told her it's, you know, it's okay to go, and we kind of told her that.
Alzheimer's, they call it the long goodbye. Each time I saw her, I grieved a little piece of her that was missing. So it was grieving for 8 years, but you could never, 8 or 10 years, but you could never, I'd never let myself go to that point of really being sad because she was still there. And so I would only allow myself to kind of get so sad to a certain point.
My mom was grieving for her mother, but because my grandma was still alive, she didn't know how to act. I think my mom might have gone through Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of grief and then found herself in that unexplored 6th stage area. She didn't know what to do. And because she lived farther away, she wasn't able to see her mother as much, and so reacted differently than Ken.
You know, I was going down as much as I could and, you know, kind of being not envious, but feeling bad for not being able to be there more. Janice and Ken spent so much more time with her, you know, mm-hmm. And they would go every weekend. The three of them hung out together. You know, they'd go to lunch and they'd get ice cream. I'm sure it's more final for them because they got to see her more than I did. So I was missing her all along. You know, they're really missing her because they got to see her all the time.
For Ken, things were different.
In some families, I mean, in most families, what happens is that some of the brothers and sisters are drawn towards the elderly to help them and do what you can for them. And then there's another sister or brother who goes in the opposite direction and doesn't spend that time with them. I know I did everything I could at the end for Mom, you know, while she was up here, and I had my time with her, and I'm very content that I was able to do that for her.
I always miss that I couldn't call her and talk to her. But I feel good because I think she was well cared for and she was surrounded by people that loved her. I have no regrets with my mom.
This is how my mom and her brother reacted to the slow passing of their mother. They started and progressed through the first five stages of preemptive grief in similar ways. But because the loss of my grandma was so drawn out, they spent a longer time in the unknown sixth stage of grief. Here, their reactions diverged, perhaps because Ken lived close to my grandma and my mom didn't. Ken saw her every week, determined to spend as much time with his mother as he could before she died. My mom saw her less frequently, and was more content to recall who her mother used to be, the mother she saw now only in glimpses. The important thing, however, is that both my mother and uncle are happy with how they spent their last months with their mom. Their reactions defy the rigid definitions given in the five-part Kubler-Ross model. They start to explore what this new sixth stage could be.
The fact that Dan's mother and uncle handled their mother's death so differently seems to underscore how strange this new space is between death's acceptance and the moment of death. We might be hardwired to grieve in a particular pattern, like Kubler-Ross says, and we might even be able to handle grieving while our loved one still lives. But there's no way we could be naturally predisposed to grieve for as long as we do now.
But we cope.
Right, we cope. And we can begin to see what this sixth stage is and how it changes the relationships we have with loved ones, whom we've already grieved, but not yet lost. My Uncle Phil passed into the Lord's hands a few days after I conducted these interviews. So now the waiting period is over. And in a way, I think Phil's children feel relieved. Finally, after 21 months of battling, struggling, and waiting, they're free to remember what it was like before cancer started colonizing their father's body. They are released to a form of grieving that is constant over all cultures and forms of loss. They tell stories.
I was running around and playing flashlight tag and went outside. And I slipped on some wet leaves and split my knee open on the corner of the cement driveway. I went to the emergency room, but I remember my father was there the whole time, holding my hand, and I think I probably gave him a few bruises by squeezing his hand so much. I'm very glad to have him with me.
Rachel Dowling, Daniel McDougall, and Tom Wiltsius are sophomores at Stanford.